May 1st, 2004, and we are in Salt Lake City at the reunion of the 71st EVAC Hospital in Vietnam, Pleiku, and I'm Kara Buick, and we're interviewing Diane Carlson Evans. So we'll start maybe with just your family background and how that led you to the path that you ended up in nursing in Vietnam.
Okay, well, I will start with growing up in Minnesota. I grew up on a dairy farm and had four brothers and one sister. My father, of course, was home 24 hours a day, every day of the week, because he was a farmer. So my dad was always around, but my mom was a registered nurse and worked full-time, raising six children. So my role modeling was that I watched a mother go off to work, and the other farmers' wives in the county were farm wives, and they didn't watch their moms go off to work. And at times I envied them because it was like, well, I want my mother home all the time too. But on the other hand, my mother was an incredible role model because I saw that she had independence because she had an education and that she was happy. And she loved going to work, and she always told me, I love going to work, honey, so don't feel sorry for me. Because I would say, oh, Mama, I'm so sorry you have to go work. So I had a wonderful role model in my mom. I also had another role model, my aunt. My mom's sister went into the Army in World War II and became a WAC. And she was a college graduate, so she was a lieutenant, and talked about her time in the military as a very positive time for her. Obviously, she was an officer, and she had her education, and she was in some positions that she enjoyed. So I didn't hear a negative side to a woman serving in World War II because her experience was positive. Extra positive because she told me if she hadn't been in the military and had the GI Bill, she never would have gotten her doctorate degree. And she went on to teach in a college in New Jersey. So now I've got two women role models. Both have educations, one with a military background. And now it's the 60s. And I graduated from high school in 1964 and went to a little one-room country school with one classmate for 8 years. And it's a little tiny, you know, like little house on the prairie school. No bathrooms, no running water, a pump outside where you went out and pumped the water and brought it in, and we all had our chores. And so in the ninth grade, I got on a school bus for the first time in my life and was very nervous about going to the big city of 2,500 population to go to high school. I was very shy. I was very worried that I would be backward, that I wouldn't dress like the other girls dress because I had to sew my own clothes, and that I wouldn't be able to keep up in school because I didn't know if I was going to be behind in math and these kinds of things. But what I found was, because I had a wonderful teacher, another good role model in my grades in my country school, that I was at the same place the high school kids were in all my classes and didn't have any trouble transitioning into that. So I had 4 years of what I would say a happy time in high school. But all my friends were country girls, and I related only to the country girls. And we were stigmatized and stereotyped as country bumpkins, and we were the girls that had to sew our own clothes, and we were the girls that had to go out and help milk the cows before we went to school. And so I always felt like I was so proud of my parents for working so hard and being, and we were on a beautiful farm. It was one of the prettiest farms in Minnesota. So I grew up in a beautiful setting and had my own horses, and we all had our own horses. But I was always made to feel like, well, because I wasn't a city girl, I wasn't really hip, or, you know, I couldn't be a cheerleader, heaven forbid. I wouldn't even try out to be a cheerleader. And my friends all wanted to get married when they were seniors, and they had steady boyfriends, and I thought, how stupid is that, to wear a boy's ring around your neck that has adhesive tape around it, so if you take it off your neck, it'll fit your finger. I wasn't interested in boys, and I guess the boys knew it, so I was not asked out on any dates. And I went to prom both times with my girlfriends from the country. And I know I wore my hair in braids and looked like a country girl too. But I wanted to go to school. I wanted to go to college. And my mother impressed upon my sister and I, more so my sister, because the boys would take over the farm. And for boys, it was okay then to take over a farm and they didn't have to go to college. At least that was kind of the sense of my mom. But for us girls, we were going to college, and there was no question or doubt about it. We better start planning for it, which is how wonderful. So I had three jobs in high school. I got a job at the telephone office and was a telephone operator and made $1.25 an hour, and that was the minimum paid at that time. That was good pay for a 16-year-old. I worked at the hospital with my mother, and on weekends, I cleaned this lady's house in town. Mm-hmm. So I was combining my schoolwork and these three jobs so that I could have money in the bank to start college. And I never spent any of the money. I took it right to the bank and deposited it. Therefore, I had to still keep sewing my own clothes. There wasn't any extra money for any frivolous things like going to the drive-in and having a hamburger, which was a big thing in the 60s. So anyway, long story short, I decided to go to a 3-year nursing program because it was cheaper. And I hadn't saved enough money for college. I wanted to go to St. Olaf in Minnesota, which had a 4-year nursing program, but I had only saved enough money to pay for a 3-year program, and that's what my mother went to. And she was a good nurse, and so I thought, well, I'll go to the 3-year program. I graduated in 1967 from St. Barnabas Hospital, and I was in a wonderful place. It was a wonderful school of nursing, and we did our academic work at the University of Minnesota. So I had very good professors and very good teachers, and our hospital was very progressive, thank goodness, because when I decided to go to Vietnam, thank goodness the hospital that I was at was just starting intensive care. Think about it. You think intensive care has been around forever, but it was just beginning in the 60s. So in intensive care, I was caring for really seriously ill patients, and they let me start IVs. So I was getting some good experience, and I decided to do my 2 internships at a VA hospital and at Hennepin County General Hospital, which was the worst hospital in Minneapolis and got in all the car accidents. And, well, back then it was called where the poor people went, because they couldn't afford the other hospitals. And so they got the Saturday night specials, which were the murders and wounds and knife stabbings and gunshots. And the emergency room was an absolute nightmare. But I wanted to be in that emergency room because by this time I've decided I want to join the Army and I want to go to Vietnam. So I wanted to get all the experience I could. And then at the VA hospital, I thought, well, if I go to the VA, I'll be taking care of veterans. And maybe that'll help me in the military. Who are these guys? What are they like? And those 2 experiences were wonderful. And they did help me. Now, just think about it. In 1967, when I was doing my internship at the VA, I was taking care of World War I veterans who were missing limbs, who were having still complications, who were dying now from terrible wounds from the war, or they were dying from psychological wounds and alcoholism and all the kinds of things that are part of your life, if you look at it holistically, that happened to war veterans. And I was taking care of World War II veterans and Korean veterans and a few Vietnam vets who were coming into the VA system in the late 60s. So I had the whole gamut. I had a century of veterans that I was caring for. And what I found out was these guys were all alike. They were just different ages, and they had all suffered the same thing. It didn't matter what the name of the war was. These veterans were all the same. The older guys were like my dad, and they were just the sweetest guys, and they were so appreciative of their care. They just were so, I was, you know, back then we wore these cute little blue and white checked uniforms with a white pinafore over it, and our cute little white hat, and our white stockings, and our white shoes, because this is still the 60s. So I came in, and I swear those guys looked at me and thought I was 10 years old. I really looked young when I was that age. And it was like they played tricks on me, really terrible tricks, to just kind of make me embarrassed or laugh. But pretty soon, they found out I'd start playing tricks on them to get back at them. Uh-huh. So it was like, I made it fun. Uh-huh. And we really became close. I became close to my patients. And when they found out after I was about to leave that I'd signed up for Vietnam, and this one older gentleman said, and he got these big tears. I'll never forget this man. He got these big tears in his eyes. And it was my last day on the unit. And he knew I was going to Vietnam, or I'd volunteered for Vietnam. There was no orders yet. But he said, you take good care of those boys over there. And so I knew then that I was doing the right thing. I was going to volunteer for Vietnam. Now, step back a minute. I had already signed up for the Army Student Nurse Program because I'm a senior now. Mm-hmm. It's 1967. I'm a senior. And I went downtown Minneapolis and found an Army recruiter and said, how do I join the military? I said, I think I want to join the Army instead of the Navy or the Air Force because I think probably in the Army we'll get to go where the action is and where the real fighting is. Uh-huh. And I really want to be on the ground and not on a ship or in the air or whatever. When you're that age, you have these, you know, Air Force must be in the air, and Navy, you're only on a ship, and I wanted to be on the ground. I'm a farm girl. And so this recruiter said to me, she said, well, she said, I have the paperwork right here. You can sign it today if you like. Of course, she's a recruiter, and they have to get so many recruits in. Was she ever happy to see me? She said, where are you at in your nursing program? And I said, well, I'll be a senior in September. And she said, well, the Army will pay your senior year. I said, what? She said, the Army has a program called the Army Student Nurse Corps Program. You don't have to leave. You don't have to go outside your hospital. We pay you to stay. We pay your tuition, your books, your uniform, and we give you a stipend of $200 a month. And I said, what do I do with the $200? That's a lot of money. She said, "That's your, you spend that however you want." I didn't even go downtown for an ice cream cone. That's how poor I was. Mm-hmm. And so this was like too good to be true. I wanted to go in anyway, but, and now they're going to pay me. So then she explained that the obligation would be 2 years. And she said, so you get a year paid for, and you only have to serve 2 years. And I said, well, I really want to join because I want to go to Vietnam. Is there any guarantee? And she said, well, to be honest with you, there are no guarantees in the military, but I can almost guarantee you, you will go to Vietnam if you want to go, because she knew the war was escalating. This was the middle of 67, summer of 67. So I signed up, and I didn't tell my parents, I just did it.
Mm-hmm. That day?
That day. I just made up my mind. Mm-hmm. And this had been brewing for a long time. My oldest brother fell out of an airplane and injured his knees and was discharged from the military. He was in the 101st Airborne. My second brother got drafted and was in Korea. And my parents were so relieved. His orders could have been Vietnam. He was in Korea when I went to sign up for the military. And now going back to kind of the traditional family that I grew up in and traditional things about serving your country, but in my family, it was men serve their country. And I'm thinking, my brothers got drafted. They had to go in the military. They have to go off to strange places. And now the 60s, this whole kind of women's activism and women coming into their own and kind of asking questions about where they're at in this society and all the activism. Now there's the anti-war protests and women are protesting the war. Men are protesting the war, and there's a lot of anti-war sentiment already. But that didn't bother me, because I was already sensing, well, I don't think I support that war either, but I don't know enough about it at that point. Do I support it or not? But it didn't matter, because what I wanted to do was support the troops who were there. And if I was a nurse, why couldn't I go to Vietnam as a nurse? That wouldn't be supporting the war. That's taking care of the fallout from the war. So I didn't have any moral dilemma about, gee, I can't join the Army and go to Vietnam if I don't support the war. That just, you know, didn't matter to me at all. So, and I was the only woman in my class who was glued to the 6 o'clock news. In my nurses training, in our building, it was all women. We didn't have any male nurses. We were confined to our building and couldn't leave after, we had to be in by 9 o'clock at night, and it was all for safety because it's downtown Minneapolis. And there was one television for 45 students. It was in the nurses, student nurse lounge. And so I was the only student who went down there at 6 o'clock every night to watch the Vietnam news. I was glued to it. I wanted to know what was happening in Vietnam. And I was hearing about the casualties, and I was seeing the casualties, and I was, the images, every image that I saw, and I would have remembered if there was an image of a woman, but when I watched the 6 o'clock news, there were no images of women in Vietnam. Not a single image. They didn't show a nurse, a Red Cross woman, I saw images of helicopter pilots. I saw images of body bags out in the field. They were always referred to as men. Men, you know, scrambling around, and men in tanks, and men running, and men with weapons, and then the horrible images of men wounded, which were very graphic at the time. And no images of women. So it was like, well, gee, I wonder if there are any women there, but there must be some nurses there. And of course, the nurse recruiter said there was, but I wondered, why aren't we seeing the women? And then the broadcaster, the journalist, or the anchor person, who would be talking about the war, always said, and the men this, and the men that, and the men are going here, and the men are going there. It was never the men and women in Vietnam. Never. And that's changed. Today, you don't hear First President Bush or Second President Bush ever. It's always the men and women serving in Kuwait or Iraq or wherever. Mm-hmm. They always say men and women, but that didn't happen during Vietnam, believe me. And so I'm already starting to feel isolated, like I'm a little different. I'm a little outside the norm here because my classmates all think I'm crazy. First of all, why would you want to do your internship at the VA? It's dirty, it's old, it's depressing. Nobody did their internship at the VA, but that's where I wanted to be. And it was a very positive experience for me. So anyway, I'm now graduated from nursing, and I have to take my state boards, because unless you pass your state board, you can't get into the military. You have to be a full-fledged registered nurse before you get into the Army Nurse Corps. So of course I passed that, spent the summer riding my horses and being a camp nurse, taking ticks out of children's heads. And in Wisconsin, I went to this camp for disadvantaged children, and that was a wonderful experience. A little kid chopped his toe off, so I thought, well, I've seen a battlefield amputation. The kid had his axe and chopped his big toe off. And everybody was just like running away. They didn't want to look at it. And I just picked up the toe and I said, well, we're going to put it in a plastic bag. We're going to put it in ice. And we had to drive 40 miles to a medical clinic with this little boy and his little amputated toe. And I kept telling him, it's not so bad. It's just your toe. Could have been your leg or your arm. I said, you'll be okay. They'll probably even sew it back on. Don't worry about it. I was like hugging him and trying to make him feel better. So the camp experience was great, but then now I get my state boards and I get orders to go to basic training, which, and I do want to talk briefly about that, because I think what's important in what you're doing your dissertation on and talking about differences with gender and stereotypes and myths and what women need for training and what men need for training back then was very different. And so my basic training was a lot of classroom, which I found fascinating. It wasn't all that helpful for Vietnam, but we learned about biological warfare, chemical warfare. I don't think they mentioned Agent Orange, though. It was just very sort of superficial stuff. And they didn't warn us that, oh, you may be exposed to Agent Orange and have problems the rest of your life. They sure did not say that. That was very superficial, very secret. And they taught us how to salute, and they taught us how to march, which I thought was such a joke. It's like, why do nurses know how to march? Why do they have to know how to salute? We have to salute people? Nurses? It's like, well, that's the military. And then they gave us a card that we were to carry at all times in our pocket. And it had what it means to be an officer. And it had the rules of being an officer, which are the typical things, carry yourself with dignity or whatever. And then it says, you are now an officer and a gentleman. And they hadn't quite got up to speed, and this is even late 60s, but now I'm a gentleman. So basic training, once we got out into the field, was a lot of just playing war games, learning how to carry a gurney, practicing on bodies that, you know, were bloody, and putting on splints, and learning what a lister bag is, and learning what some terminology is, that when we got to Vietnam, if somebody said, go find the lister bag, you wouldn't say, what's that? Well, it's the water bag. And, you know, words like latrine, well, I think I knew what that word meant growing up on a farm. And so some of it was just sort of basic, superficial stuff. And I knew my whole 6 weeks in that training that they were not preparing us for Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I just, after working in the emergency room, seeing my mom take care of car accidents come in, like 5 or 6 people in a car accident come in, and the heinous activity in an emergency room when people come in that big of numbers. And I thought, when are they going to really start getting serious about preparing us for Vietnam? But they never, I never felt they really did. And I went to basic in the fall of 67. I think at the time they were trying. And then later I thought, well, how really could they prepare? War can't, you can't be prepared for war. Only war prepares you for war. That's the reality. And I, at least I was feeling that I had some decent training. I know I've talked to a lot of women who were absolutely terrified. They came maybe out of a baccalaureate degree program, which was a college-based program, which are wonderful programs, but they didn't get the kind of training we did. They hadn't started IVs. They hadn't been to an emergency room for 3 months and taken care of, you know, trauma. And they just didn't feel they had the skills yet. They developed them later. But I felt ready. I mean, maybe that was naive too. And it was in a way, because I really wasn't ready once I got there. But at least I wasn't terrified on the airplane. Mm-hmm. That I was worried that, I guess I was worried. I thought about, I guess my biggest fear was that I wouldn't be good enough, and what if somebody died on my watch? And I could not let that happen. And I think I was already sort of gearing up that I had to be perfect, you know, like, so I guess, you know, I went to Vietnam feeling like, well, how brave would I be? How quick would I be? How good would I be? Would I know my nursing? What didn't I know about nursing that I would have to do? And how would I react to, you know, seeing people my age killed and wounded? And it's different in a car accident, I decided. A car accident is a car accident if they happen. Or somebody falls out of a tree and breaks their leg and they come into the, well, they fell out of a tree. Or in the emergency rooms, the homicides and the people who were drunk stabbing each other, well, that's human nature, you know. They shouldn't be drunk and they're stabbing each other. Let's take care of them and get them better and get them out of here. And I discovered when I got to Vietnam, my God, our government is killing these young men, our government, for a war that's wrong. Because I, by this time, I went to Vietnam, now let me get back and start there. Had basic training. Then I went to Fort Lee, Virginia, because I had volunteered and they had seen my volunteer paperwork. But in their wisdom, which was wise, they saw that I was right out of nurses' training. And that they thought I should have at least 9 months experience before I went to Vietnam. Where they came up with 9 months, I don't know. But 9 months to the day, I was on my way to Vietnam. But I'm so glad I had that experience at Fort Lee, Virginia, because I was on an orthopedic unit caring for soldiers. And now when I say soldiers, I'm saying men. They're all men back then. We weren't caring for female soldiers. And although some of us were wounded in Vietnam, and certainly they were cared for, but I never cared for a female soldier once. So when I refer to the soldiers, I'm referring to the men. But at Fort Lee, I got to know these guys. And they knew I was going to Vietnam, and this was my training. So they did all kinds of things to train me. Again, playing tricks on me, and like, Lieutenant, when you get to Vietnam, you better be aware of this and this and this. And it was really interesting, and I just fell in love with all these guys. They were just so great to take care of. And I learned how to start IVs even better, and I got quick at starting IVs, and I learned how to do nasogastric and do a lot of the technical things that I would have to do when I got to Vietnam. But also I learned things like, I was just brand new on duty. They put me on nights. They put all the young ones on nights, the worst duty. And so these guys are sleeping. And I have to wake one of them up to give him his oral medication. Is that too cold? Don't just wait. You can shut it off if you want. And so getting back to taking care of the patients at Fort Lee, Virginia, in this orthopedic unit, and at night, I was going around passing out medications, and this guy needed oral medication, so I had to wake him up. So unthinking, I went to the end of his bed, and I didn't want to, like, just startle him. So I just grabbed his leg and shook his leg, and he just went hysterical. and he screamed and he hit the floor and got under the bed. And talk about a startle reflex. Well, I had no idea what I'd done. But he woke everybody up. Everybody is now awake, because that was, it was very noisy when he fell and scrambled and got under his bed and was holding his head down and he was saying things. And he had been in a deep sleep, and I woke him up, and of course he thought it was the VC or the enemy, and he was just looking for his gun, and he was like under the bed looking for his gun. And I realized what I had done. So he was so angry. He cried, because by now he's humiliated, because it's, what have I done? And all the guys are like, they know me by this time, and I'm this little redheaded, freckle-faced, 21-year-old nurse. And they just love to tease me, and it's like, what the hell do you think you're doing, Lieutenant? You do that in Vietnam and you're dead. They'll have your head. He crawls out from under the bed and he says, don't you ever do that again. Because I had frightened him and startled him enough that he thought he was back in Vietnam. And so just realized, oh my God, these guys are just on alert. Oh, they were still on alert. Of course, they'd just come from Vietnam. So they're not only on alert, they're hyper-vigilant. Every little sound, every little thing, they hear it and they wake up. So you had to be ultra-quiet. It was impossible to be ultra-quiet. But then they were so good-natured, they took it really well. And then, of course, I could never live it down. I was going to be the worst nurse in Vietnam. They said, you just, there's no hope for you. You know, it's like... And so there was a lot of razzing and teasing and that kind of thing on this unit. And what I saw in that was the camaraderie. These guys were so tight with each other. And they were always watching out for each other and offering each other cigarettes. And because this is an open unit, an open ward, where all the guys are together and they're only separated by screens. And so everybody could see everybody else, see how everybody else is doing, and they're always checking up on each other. And if so-and-so isn't doing well, one of them will come up and say, hey, you know, he needs some pain medication, you know. And then you run to this guy and say, you having some pain? And yeah, but they don't complain. You know, they just wouldn't complain. And you really had to be observant and go by maybe their vital signs or their body language to see if they were in pain, because they were trying to be so stoic. And when you put young boys with other young boys, these are 19, 20 young men, they don't want to look like complainers. And if this guy over here, which some of them were missing their legs, or were in 15 different pulleys, you know, every limb and anything possible was up in a pulley, and they had Foley bags and IVs. And if that's the guy next to you, and you're laying there and you don't have any of that, but you're in pain, you might not complain of pain, because look at that guy, he's got it so much worse. So I learned to be observant, and that these guys weren't always going to tell you what their problems were, and that they would take care of each other. And then the little things like, don't startle them. Learn how to wake them up without, you know, doing that. And I guess the camaraderie really struck me, how much these kids really care about each other. And then by the end, they were all sad. Now, these were long-term guys. These were in for rehabilitation. So I got close to these guys. I was there 9 months. Some of them would stay a month. Some would stay. Some of them were there 6 months. And some were maybe there for a week, and then they were good enough to go to a VA hospital, or they were being discharged or whatever. But I got close to a lot of these guys, and they didn't want me to leave. So they wrote a petition, and they all signed it. And there were like 60 patients on this unit. And they signed this petition and sent it to the chief nurse, Colonel Sears, and it said, we refuse to allow Lieutenant Carlson to go to Vietnam. She has to stay at Fort Lee, Virginia. So anyway, these guys, I mean, what a more wonderful compliment. It was so sweet. It wasn't going to keep me from Vietnam. And yeah. Then I told them, so I get this back from Colonel Sears, and this was a secret. They didn't let me know they were signing this petition. So Colonel Sears comes up into the unit, and she says to me, she takes me aside, and she says, Lieutenant, did you put these guys up to this? You don't want to go to Vietnam? I thought you volunteered for Vietnam. I said, Colonel Sears, what are you talking about? I volunteered for Vietnam. When are you going to send me? And she said, look at this. So she shows me this petition. All these patients have signed this, that they refuse to allow me to go to Vietnam. And Colonel Sears says, well, what can I do but keep you here? And I got this long look on my face, and I said, I do want to go to Vietnam, Colonel Sears. I hope you get, you know, get orders. And she said, well, you're on orders right now. Your orders have come through. And so this was going, I was just going to be a couple more days on the unit, and then I was going to go back to Minnesota and visit my family. But it was so touching. So I went back to all these guys and told them how mad I was at them for trying to keep me at Fort Lee, the pit of the world, you know. Well, Virginia was beautiful, and I mean, it was a nice hospital, but I didn't want to stay there. I wanted to go on to other things. And so it was a really nice farewell, and I felt really supported, and that was a nice send-off. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't get a good send-off from my community because the war now, it's now July of 1968, so it's the height of the war. We've sent more troops to Vietnam. We're escalating the war instead of de-escalating the war, which LBJ had talked about. But now we're escalating the war. More and more troops are being drafted. More and more families and communities are irate that the war is continuing and that more troops are going. And when I left Fort Lee, Virginia, I had to fly out of Washington National Airport to get to Minnesota. And the person that took me to the airport, and getting to the airport, you see the mall and the Capitol and the Washington Monument, and that was what they called Tent City. I looked out and I couldn't believe it because I hadn't been into Washington recently. On the mall in Washington were thousands of tents with war protesters, and there were fires all over the city, and there were fires in the tents because they were cooking in there. And somebody had just blown up a car and blown up a building. There was some bomb somewhere, and I saw these little fires around the city. And then the anti-war protesters had their signs up, and they were ranting, you know, peace, not war, all the 60s things that were being said. Hell no, we won't go. What were some of the others? Oh, I'll have a flashback now of all those things that were being said during the war protests, because there were so many slogans. Man, you don't remember, you're too young. But hell no, we won't go. And oh, draft cards were being burned. And so that was my send off to Vietnam. That's the way the country felt. And it was anti-government, but it had become anti-soldier. Unfortunately, people weren't separating the soldier. Take it out on the government. Don't take it out on the soldiers. They were just being drafted, and people like me, why take it out on me? I'm a nurse who wants to go take care of these guys. Take it out on the government. But it somehow, they didn't separate that, and the soldiers became the scapegoat. And I was already beginning to sense that and feel that. And I thought at the time, you know, I'm not supporting this war either. Increasingly, I'm feeling like, why are we there? And why are things getting better over there? They're getting worse, and we've been there since 64, earlier with the advisors. So I go back to Minnesota, which is very peaceful, and my wonderful family on the farm. My younger sister and two younger brothers are crying because they don't want their big sister to go away for a year, because I'm really close to my younger siblings, because I was kind of their mother, because my mother went off to work. Mm-hmm. So my little siblings were, you know, I was really close to them. And they didn't want me to leave, and especially to go to a war. And I didn't tell my parents this, but what I had done was I had a picture taken of me in my uniform so I could give that to them before I left. And it was a really nice picture in my dress blues uniform, so that if something happened to me, they'd have this nice picture of me. So I was already thinking I might not come home. And I went to a lawyer in town and drew up a will. I mean, now at 21, what did I have to give away? Not much, but there would be something. And I didn't tell my parents that, but then I took it to the bank and put it in a lockbox in my parents' box. And then I left a note with the bank that if anything happens to me, contact my parents and give them the key to this box. So I talked to the bank. Actually, I talked to the bank president because he was friends of my parents. Mm-hmm. The bank president was friends of my mom and dad. And said, well, if anything happens to me, give this key to my parents, and then in that lockbox with a letter to them telling them I love them and my will and everything. So I wasn't going into this naive that nothing was going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. If I had, I wouldn't have done these things. So I spent some time with my family, and Mom wanted to give me a going away party, and I said, no, Mom, this isn't party time. I don't feel like a party. So I leave for Oakland, California. There's another woman on the airplane with me to Vietnam, so we sit together, and we are in these god-awful uniforms that they force us to sit in, you know, with the girdle and the nylons and the pointed toe shoes and the and the short skirts, because our skirts had to be to the knee, they had to be perfectly hemmed. But we didn't get issued the jungle fatigues and combat boots till we got in country. So we're sitting on a plane for 2 days feeling really uncomfortable and really out of place in these dressy uniforms when we're going up to Vietnam. But that's, we were just supposed to look military and look pretty and look the part, you know. And we were advised, of course, of basic training on good grooming and, and that kind of thing, because we were supposed to look feminine. And
what kinds of things did they say?
Well, they actually told us that the Navy had tried, the Navy was grooming their women, and they were showing us pictures. And the Navy women had to go to classes to learn how to put on cosmetics and do their hair, because the Navy really wanted their women looking beautiful in their uniforms. And us Army nurses were like gasping at this, like, if they send me to some school to learn how to put on makeup, I will refuse to go. I'll probably get an Article 15, and I haven't even been to Vietnam yet, but like, I'm not going to be taught how to put on makeup or how to do my hair. I don't wear makeup. I didn't then. I do now. And my hair was long, and I just put it behind my head, and I didn't want to be taught how to do my hair. Well, anyway, the Army was threatening to do that to us, to send us to class, if we just didn't really concentrate on our grooming and look the part of being a woman. And so we were forced to wear our dress uniforms to Vietnam, and were, of course, very uncomfortable. And as the minute we got there, we were hot, and we had to get out of them. I mean, we had hose on, and shoes that are too tight, because they were the pointed toe shoes, and then these cute little purses that looked like little boxes like Jackie and Onassis carried, instead of, you know, something functional, like gear. And remember, I'm a farm girl, and I'm into gear and being functional, and I thought this was all the silliest stuff. This was just silly. But anyway, the good thing was they told us that we would not have to wear white uniforms, the starched white uniforms, and the white hats, that we would get jungle fatigues. So we did immediately get issued the jungle fatigues, and they were so comfortable. The boots weren't at first, but they became comfortable. But then the next step was to get our orders, and I got orders for the 36th Evacuation Hospital in Vung Tau, and I was told how lucky I was because Vung Tau was on the ocean. Now, lots of the hospitals were Quy Nhon, Da Nang. Several hospitals were right on the South China Sea, and any nurse that got a South China Sea hospital felt lucky because it was the beach. So I was feeling like, oh, this is wonderful. I'm going to be in a beautiful place, and it'll probably be safe. It's on the ocean. And so I had a helicopter ride, and I have to say that there were several things that happened to me my first few days in Vietnam where I really, now I know I'm in a war zone, and I'm going to have to learn to watch my back and learn for the clues of what's around me. And again, being a farm girl, I always was watching my back because we had dairy cows, we had bulls, we had horses, we had pigs, we had geese, we had chickens. And we had all the dairy farm animals, and you were always really careful when you fed them and when you were out in the pasture with them, because if the dog was with you, great, but, you know, my brother was rolled by a bull and almost was killed, and I don't know, I think I grew up in an environment that taught me some things that translated to good things in Vietnam. Also, I'd been raised with brothers and was outdoorsy, and I think that was all a combination of things that helped me over there. And I love my dad, and so I really got along well with men and my brothers. And I think that, again, that's why all my patients in Vietnam, those guys were like my brothers. They were. It's like I have to take care of them like I would take care of my brothers. And I think I said, or maybe I didn't say, and I wanted to say that when I left Vietnam, that before going to Oakland, California, my mom took me to the airport, and it was the last day of July, so my dad was in the field mowing hay, or bringing the hay bales up, because it was going to rain. Now, in Minnesota, when it's going to rain, looks like rain, it will rain. And if you're a farmer, you're out there bringing the hay bales in, because that is the priority. So my dad did not go to the airport to say goodbye to me, and I'm going off to a war, but my dad has to get the hay in. But I understood that. It wasn't like I hated my dad the rest of my life because he didn't go with me to the airport and I'm going off to a war zone. It was, when you're a farmer, that's the priority. So I said goodbye to my dad, and my dad never cries. And he never saw him cry. And he gives me this hug, and I think he was unprepared for it too, but he burst into tears. And he hugged me and he said, "I have 4 sons and I send my daughter off to war." He broke into sobs. And he got in his tractor and went out to the field. And my mom took me to the airport. I did just have to say that. Because again, it's this traditional thing. A father back then didn't think about sending his daughter off to war. Also, what I just didn't say, and I need to say, in talking about the gender issues, was the stereotypes of women in the military. My 2 brothers now, my 1 brother's in Korea, my other brother was just discharged because he hurt his knees from his parachute fall. My brothers did not want their sister in the Army. They were in the Army and they said, "Women are not treated well in the Army. Why are you doing this? Don't go in the Army. You'd just be treated horrible." And they were not supportive of my being there because they felt that women in the Army were treated like less than they should have been. And I talked to them about that later and learned that they were enlisted men. So the only women they knew were the enlisted women. And they felt like the enlisted women were not treated with respect. And that there were, you know, boys are, vulgar things were said about the women who were enlisted. And I don't want to repeat those because you can imagine what they are. And that, you know, only women who were losers would go in the Army. Those kinds of things. And those stereotypes and those myths that I want to talk about later as I decided to build a memorial to honor women was I was going to do what I could to defy that myth and that stereotype, because once I got into the Army, I found out, well, those things aren't true. These are some of the greatest women I've ever met, enlisted and officer. And of course, because I was an officer, an Army nurse, yes, I think when I was in the military during the 60s and 70s, I think I was treated with better respect than was enlisted women. And I didn't think that was right. Just because I'm an officer, I should get more respect. You know, why? What is this caste system? Well, the military is a caste system, but it doesn't make it right. And, you know, these young enlisted women would tell me about having to live in the barracks, and their job in the morning was with a toothbrush to get the dirt out of all the cracks between the wood and the wood floors, and they'd have to be down there. And I thought, what? Toothbrush on the floor with a mop and soap getting wood out of the cracks between the wood planks on the flooring? Wouldn't... Anyway. All right. Going to my first assignment at Bung Tao, the 36th Evac. A memory that will never leave me is when the helicopter came to get just me. So it's like, well, I must be important. This helicopter came in just for me. Of course, that's what happens every day in Vietnam. Helicopters come in to take people to get them places. We were forbidden, the nurses, we were briefed and forbidden to ride in convoys because they were very unsafe. So I thought, well, those poor guys, it's okay for them to be unsafe, but us women, we get to ride in a safer, not that helicopters were always safe because they got shot out of the sky, but I'm already starting to feel like we're given some priorities. But, of course, we're nurses, and they want to take good care of us because without nurses, you know. What I discovered was that those guys took good care of us because we were taking good care of them. There was the balance. There was the equality. And so those guys would do anything to take good care of us. And when I got in this helicopter, there was the helicopter pilot and the crew chief in front, and sitting right next to me was a young soldier with a bandolier of ammunition that was full, and his machine gun and some other weapons that he had, and the chopper lifted up. He did not say a word to me. He was extremely quiet. He was looking down at the ground the whole time. He was totally concentrated on what he was doing. He could have cared less about this little Army nurse sitting next to him, I thought. So he's concentrating on the ground. He's looking down there. He's looking all over the place. He's got this gun poised, ready to shoot, and I'm thinking, I wonder what he's looking for down there. And of course, you know, I knew what he was looking for. Enemy fire that was waiting to shoot us down. He didn't say a word the whole trip to Bung Tao. So now we're flying over and see the South China Sea. I see the big red crosses on top of the hospitals, and I thought, wow, those big red crosses on top of the hospitals look like wonderful targets. Why did they do that? And then the landing pad, we landed. It was time for me to get off, and the only thing the door gunner said to me as I left was, "Keep your head down, ma'am, and be safe." And that's the last thing he told me. I never got his name. But keep your head down, ma'am, and be safe. I mean, his job on that chopper was to get me to the hospital safely, and he did. Now he was up and off to doing something else. So I was at Vung Tau for 5 months and working on a busy surgical ward as a staff nurse, and then I got transferred to the burn unit. And the burn unit was really tough because it was the napalm, white phosphorus, any kind of burn, grenade burns, anything that caused a fire and caused somebody to be burned was on our unit. And some of these burns were just horrendous. And a lot of them were children because the villages had been bombed and they brought the kids in. And working in a burn unit is just painful to see their pain and that you can't do anything for their pain because sometimes, especially for the children, we couldn't really give them much pain medication because it's not absorbed the way it's normally absorbed because of the nature of burns. And a lot of it is tactical because you had to touch the burns, you had to touch the wound because you had to debride it. And when you debride it, you're taking off the necrotic dead tissue. So you're actually, you know, with your instruments, taking off dead skin. And every time you do that, they cry out in pain, but it has to be done because you have to get the dead skin away so the new overgrowth, the new skin can come. And then you're smearing sulfamylon over that burn and it burns. The sulfamylon stings. So everything you do to these patients hurts them, and you can't move them without hurting them. And you have to take them to, physically take them to the physical therapy tub where they're immersed in the water. And then the physical therapist is causing more pain. And it's like for nurses, we're always trying to ease the suffering. And in this unit, it's like we're just causing more pain. But although these patients were so grateful for anything that you could do for them to help them feel more comfortable. And of course, we did that in as many ways as we could. But now I'm into my 5th month, and I'm down on the South China Sea, and I'm really feeling, I don't know why, but I feel like I need to transfer and want to go north where more of the fighting is. And I don't know, feel more needed or feel, Vung Tau was a very, considered a safe place. Of course, after I left, they got rocketed. But I felt like I was in kind of a nice, too nice a place for Vietnam, and I wanted to go someplace where the real war was. So I went to the chief nurse, and she said, "You what? You want to leave Vung Tau?" And I said, "Well, I just think I need another experience, and I'd like to go north." Well, she said, "Well, there's a lot of people up there that would like to come here, so yeah, I'll let you go. I'll find a place where they need you." So a couple days later, she said, "Well, we're sending you to Pleiku." Well, when I told my colleagues I was going to Pleiku, they said, "You're what?" I was like, and so I got on a chopper, flew to Quy Nhon, spent the night, and then 2 chopper pilots took me over the jungle, and I thought, I'm glad I've done this. I'm seeing Vietnam. Because when I went over the jungle, over the Second Highlands, it was totally different, because the delta is very different than the highland area, and it was just beautiful. It was just gorgeous, just thick jungle and mountains. And then we landed Pleiku, and I'm wondering, why is this place all brown? Well, Agent Orange had come in big time and sprayed everything to defoliate. Why is all that stuff dead? I just flew over this beautiful, lush jungle. Mm-hmm. So how did they do this? And of course, being a farm girl, my dad used 2,4-D, which has dioxin in it, to get rid of the weeds. But I've never even heard of Agent Orange or Agent Blue or Agent White in these barrels. But then the chopper's coming down, and not far from, I think, what was the hospital at the time, there's all these orange barrels. And I remember seeing barrel after hundreds of barrels that were orange, and I thought, what is in orange barrels? Still not knowing or hearing what this is all about. And so I went from Vung Tau to Pleiku, and what happened at Pleiku was instantly, she said, "Lieutenant, you're going to be head nurse on a surgical unit. It's a major slot. I'm 22. I just had my 22nd birthday. I was 21 when I went to Vietnam. For the first time now, I'm really scared. Because I'm a head nurse, and see, now our patient, it's different. Our patients are coming to us right out of the field. They're being injured just minutes away. Sometimes the chopper would come 10, 20 minutes and bring in the wounded. So now we have fresh casualties right with their uniforms still on, coming into our hospital, and in huge numbers because we're supporting the 4th Infantry Division, and they're really being hit up in this area, and they're coming in from Cambodia. And the government is lying to us and saying we're not in Cambodia, and then we get patients from Cambodia. So now also my whole thing about the war is like, why are these young men dying? The protests in America are increasing. The protests against our soldiers who are dying over here is increasing. LBJ is lying to us. The whole government is lying to us. They're not giving us a really clear mission about why we're staying. And the guys are coming in wounded and saying, well, we took this hill, but we just took it 2 weeks ago. And then we lost it and we have to go take it again. It's like, why are we taking these hills only to lose it and take them again? So thankfully I had that experience in the burn unit and on the staff unit. But I was worried about being head nurse. That means I'm in charge. But you quit thinking about that and you just get busy. And I had a wonderful office. Oh, most incredible man was our ward master. His name was Sergeant Saltis. He was a World War II veteran, and his name was Saltis, but I have to tell you, he was just this salty old guy who was the consummate sergeant who was wonderful. He was smart, he was fast, he knew his job. He would pat me on the shoulder and say, Lieutenant, don't worry about that. That's my job. Because the chief nurse came in to me and said, when I got there was a medical unit, but there were so many wounded coming in, they had to change it to a surgical unit. So the chief nurse comes in and just dumps this on me, because I'm the head nurse. She said, Lieutenant, I want this to be a surgical unit by tomorrow. I was like, and she left. She walked out the door. But Sergeant Saltis had heard her, and he said, Lieutenant, that's my job. This will be a surgical unit tomorrow. You just get busy. You get the IVs in here. You get the medication. You get everything you need to turn this into a surgical unit for things that you need it for, the equipment, get the respirators, you know. And, well, he got the respirators, actually. I didn't have to deal with that. But I got, you know, the morphine, all the kind of stuff I knew I'd need for a surgical unit. And the next day we started getting casualties. And it was that time from January of 69 to July 30th of 69 when I was at Pleiku was sort of like we had our Tet, whereas Tet was, you know, when they referred to Tet, was the Tet of 69. We had times when we would get, there was a time we got in two Chinooks, of helicopters and had 84 casualties come in at once. And that was the night that my telephone rang. Now, remember, I'm working days because I'm the head nurse, but days for me meant I got on the unit at 6 and I didn't leave till 8 or 9 at night. I left when the work was done. And the phone was ringing in the middle of the night and I go answer it and the supervisor is saying, Lieutenant, I want you to go open the spare ward immediately. Mass casualties are coming in. I don't remember the name of that unit, but it was a ward next to ours that was empty just for that. It could be kept as a spare ward. And so she said to open it up for surgical, for casualties, for wounded, and I didn't know what was coming in. So I called one of the corpsmen, and we got it set up and hit an IV at every single bed. And we hung, I didn't remember it. I had written home. I wrote my mother a letter and my dad. My mom saved all my letters, unbeknownst to me. And when I reread those letters in the late 80s, I read about that night that I had written home and told mom and dad we'd had mass casualties and that I had started 27 IVs that night with a flashlight because it was blackout because we were in such a dangerous area we couldn't have lights on at night. And these guys were dehydrated and their veins had collapsed. And so the corpsman and I get, we have an IV at every bed because we have no idea how many are coming, but we're ready. Honest to God. Pretty soon the corpsmen are bringing litters and litters and litters of groaning men in. They've been triaged. They've been through the ER. The ones that had to get into the OR first were already there. The ones that were set aside were already set aside. The guys who needed less immediate care came into my unit, and I thought, and there's no doctor there to give orders. So you just take charge, because the doctor isn't there saying, well, give this guy, you know, normal saline, give this guy DWND. Just like, nobody, so we just gave the standard IV for hydration. And I said to the corpsman, as they start coming in, and they're not putting them in beds, I said to my corpsman, whose name I can't remember, I wish I could, I said, you know, we're not doing anything until we get the IV started, because that's their lifeline. So don't do anything to these guys. I don't care what they want. We're going to get their IV in first, and once that's in, then we'll start with whatever else, unless they look like they're bleeding to death or something, we're going to have to stop the bleeding. But, I mean, if they're bleeding to death, they need that IV. And they need the IV first while we can still find a vein, because we don't want them to go into shock. So it was just like immediate, and it was, we couldn't turn the lights on, because if the hospital was lit up, we were a target. So it was pitch black in there. And he had a flashlight. So McCormick held the flashlight while I started these IVs. And I could hardly get the IV started because they were so dehydrated, their IVs were gone. And but by this time, we were nurses who started IVs in Vietnam were extremely proficient because we started hundreds, if not thousands of them. So I'd really gotten good at finding the vein or thinking the vein was there and getting the IV in. So we got all the IVs started, and then we started to do the next thing was just get him undressed and see what's wrong with this guy, you know, and do our own triage and decide what the next step would be with him. And it was just like a nightmare. I saw Apocalypse Now years later, and somebody asked me who was at the movie the next day, said, "Diane, I saw you at Apocalypse Now and you were in Vietnam. That movie was so weird. Was Vietnam like that? Was that, what'd you think of the movie?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Apocalypse Now was Vietnam." Mm-hmm. For me, Vietnam was like one long hallucination. Delusional, like I must have made it up. It was so surreal, and Apocalypse Now was so surreal that was Vietnam, like that one night. And I've actually had to sit down and write about that night just to get it out and try to remember exactly what happened. And I was so glad I had written home to Mom and Dad about that night, because I remember starting all these IVs. And then just a really quick little aside that I'll share with you. After I got out of the military and got a job at North Memorial Hospital in Minneapolis on the surgical unit, the order said IV. So I went and started the IV. Well, somebody saw that there was an IV started and the extern hadn't started it. I had never heard of an extern. Well, so one of the chief nurses or nursing supervisors comes down the hall and takes me aside and says, "Miss Carlson, did you start that IV?" Well, of course, the doctor's order said IV. She said, "I told you when you had your orientation that only externs start the IVs or interns." And I said, "Well, you never explained what an extern is, first of all. What is an extern?" And she said, "Well, they're medical students who haven't graduated yet." I said, "Well, I thought that's what an intern was." "Well, they're earlier in there, whatever." And she said, "You have to be supervised 3 times before you could start an IV." And I looked at her, and you know what? I couldn't even tell her. I could not even tell her that I had started thousands of IVs in Vietnam. And it was like I wanted to almost slap her and say, "You don't know anything. You have not given me any credit for my service. You don't even care that I was in Vietnam. Nobody had even asked me, well, what did you do in Vietnam?" The only thing that was said to me on my first week on duty, when it kind of got out that I had just been back, because I had to hand in I had to fill out a form to get the job. Like, where did you graduate and what's your work experience? And of course, the only place work experience I had was Army. Mm-hmm. So it was on there, you know, Fort Lee and then Vietnam. And so this nurse comes up to me, she's my age, and she said, "Oh, I hear you were in Vietnam." And she literally looked me up and down, like she went from my feet to my, you know, and I was in a nice, clean, white, starched uniform. And she said, "Well, you don't look like you were in the Army." And I thought to myself, there's the stereotype, there's the myth. I'm supposed to be ugly, I'm supposed to have warts all over my face, I'm supposed to look like a loser, I'm supposed to look like I'm looking for a husband. And there was that myth, and that was the only thing she said to me. "Well, you don't look like you're in the Army." It was so derogatory. There was not a "thank you for serving," or "you were in Vietnam, oh, you must have all this wonderful experience, I hope I can learn something from you." Mm-hmm. Or there was no validation, none. So that's just a little aside. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in Vietnam, long story short, I serve in this unit as head nurse from January to July 30th, and I'm really getting tired. The shifts are long, the work is hard, we're short-staffed. Rosemary, who I hope you interview, was a wonderful nurse. I want to say that right up front. I had Rosemary Burke. She's just a wonderful nurse. She was young, like me. And I was probably a year older than her, so that's why I was head nurse. And my corpsmen were just phenomenal. We were such a team, but there weren't enough of us, and we were all young, and none of us had a lot of experience, but we all worked hard. And I think the single thing about us all being young We were the young caring for the young because I understand that about the average age of the patient in Vietnam was 19.4, right in there. They were 18, 19, 20, and of course we had the 30 or 40 year olds too who came in who were Korean vets and had been World War II vets. So we had all ages, but primarily young. We were the young caring for the young. Our country hadn't given us a clear goal, but each of us had our own goal, and that was that we really cared about each other and we were going to bring each other home alive. And that's why the guys were so good to us and really looked out for us, because we were looking out for them. Now another myth, I have to tell you about another myth. There was this myth, and maybe it's still there, that women can't serve in combat. Because if women serve in combat or are given combat roles, the men won't get anything done because they'll be protecting the women. They'll be so busy caring for the women that they'll lose their focus. Or they'll be distracted. Or all these things about when men are around women, they get distracted, or they're overly protective of this poor little wilting violet over here. Well, in Vietnam, us nurses, we were the women taking care of the men. And I'll give you an example. And I'm giving you this example because it's something I did, but it's something all the nurses did. And that was our SOP on a unit was if we got incoming, which we did at Pleiku, we were hit by rockets and mortars several times. When we weren't hit, there were lots of times that there were thuds right outside that were very close because they were trying to hit the radar. So even if we didn't get hit, it was like, oh shit, that was close. Mm-hmm. And you ran, your SOP was get the helmet and flak jack on it if you didn't already have it on to protect yourself. And that was the most important thing to do because you weren't good to anybody else if you got hit in the chest. So I did grab my helmet and flak jack always. It was the first thing you did. And the next thing you did was make sure all your patients were safe. And the ones who hadn't already dived under the bed, and that the guys who could were already under, they knew what to do. You didn't have to tell the guys, oh, you better get under the bed. They'd just come from the field, the jungle. They knew what to do. But then there were the guys who were hooked to so many tubes. They had chest tubes. They had tracheotomies. They had IVs in one arm, blood going in another. They had a Foley catheter. And who knows what other kind of an NG tube. They had wounds so horrific they couldn't move without being in pain. So you threw mattresses on top of him. And we had children interspersed in our whole unit because there was a pediatrician on our unit of all things. And the medics, the chopper pilots, and the guys out in the field had found out that there was a pediatrician at the hospital, so they'd bring us these sick kids. So we had always these sick kids in our unit, babies that were burned and cholera and plague and injuries, and it was 75%. Dr. Rowe, who was the pediatrician, I got in touch